Some workers came to live in Seabrook housing by a more circuitous route than the Japanese Americans from the West Coast. The relocation policy, rounding up alleged enemies from within, was hemispheric-wide, occurring simultaneously in Canada, Mexico, Central and South America, and the Caribbean. Approximately 3,000 Japanese, German, and Italian residents of Latin America were deported to the United States for internment in the American detention camps. More than two-thirds of these deportees were Japanese. 80% of them came from Peru alone, among them the Morono family. Genzo Morono and his wife Hisako were prosperous store owners in Lima. One day the police came for him. Their son Seiki, now a banker, helps translate their memories.
Detective ga daddy no name ask shite, I'm looking for you, yute, daddy mo.
Yeah. On this one Sunday, they had gone to the seashore with the family of my father's business partner. Upon their return to first Mr. Ohashi's home, they were met by two plainclothes policemen who asked, are you Mr. Ohashi? He said, yes. And they asked him to come with them. And so my father made some attempts to try to free him. During the course of this attempt, they asked who my father was, and he said that I'm Mr. Morono. And he says, well, we are looking for you as well. And so he was brought into custody and put into a jail cell in downtown Lima. The next morning, they were boarded onto trucks and headed for a destination that then was unknown. We found out from Harvey C. Gardner, this was the port city of Talara, which was the northernmost part of Peru. They were boarded onto open flatbed trucks. How many days did the trip take to Talara? Yeah, it was about a two-day trip, and they said no meals were served during the trip. And then once they reached Talara, they boarded the Frederick C. Johnson, which was an American flagship that took the first group of detainees to San Francisco. All right, from San Francisco, my father was taken to Kennedy internment camp in Texas, which was primarily for single detainees. And then in June of 1943, he went from the Kennedy internment camp to Crystal City, where he spent most of his time in detention.
U.S. ikitakara, ano, Crystal City, Johnstown.
Meanwhile, my mother, brother, and sister, who remained in Lima, knew nothing about where my father had gone, and it wasn't until 6 months later, when my father was in the Kennedy internment camp in June of 1943, that he was able to write his first letter explaining that he was alive, number one, and well, and that the U.S. government was going to be providing another ship to bring the families of those people who had been interned to join them in the camps.
Hisako Morono decided to join her husband, even though his fate in the camps was uncertain, and her friends in Peru warned against the trip to Texas. At the end of the war, like approximately 1,400 Latin American Japanese, the Moronos couldn't go home and weren't welcome to stay. Even though it had brought them here, the U.S. government viewed them as enemy aliens and wanted them deported. Some ended up in Japan. After a legal fight, others were allowed to stay in the U.S.
Only so they, you think that's the kind of ikku toko nai kara koko ikitano.
I see. Ne? When the war ended and my parents were allowed to leave the camp, their options were quite limited. They couldn't go back to Peru because the government wouldn't allow them back. And so Mrs. Nakamura, with whom you've met, and Mr. Sasaki came. Did they come down to the camp?
Yeah.
They came to Crystal City, Texas, and offered employment at Seabrook Farms for any of the internees who wanted to come. Facing no other option, they decided to come here.
今は
She said that the living conditions when they first moved to Seabrook were really appalling. It was the equivalent of a barracks with no running water, no bathroom, no shower, and I guess a potbelly stove, which was the source of heat, the main source of heat during the winter times. And it constituted such a drastic and dramatic change from the comfortable way of life that they enjoyed in Lima that my mother especially was forever crying and very, very sad that she had to be living this way through no choice of her own.
I guess what I appreciate is that they really made some incredible sacrifices for the kids. And, I mean, they basically gave up their lives so that the kids could have a future that was better than theirs.
And they never complained?
Never complained.
The Japanese often worked 12 hours a day at Seabrook Farms and did not complain. They made the best of their circumstance. Most accepted their fate gracefully. Sometimes their sense of humor got them through. At age 96, Fuji Sasaki, known as the mayor of the Japanese community, still remembers kidding C.F. Seabrook about money.
And even Mr. Seabrook, you know, I used to meet him in a plant and going around. He said, once he said, you've been mayor a long time, so I'm going to make you a governor. He was joking away. I told him, thank you, Mr. Seabrook. But governor gets more salary than mayor usually. He says, you think about that. They're joking away.
Besides the Japanese, West Indians, and the German POWs, the Seabrook family was to draw upon another labor source after the war. As the Russians advanced into Germany, refugees from the Soviet Union fled westward. Their plight concerned C.F. Seabrook, who had spent time in Eastern Europe. Again, his son Jack Seabrook.
Then, when the war was over, he went back to Europe for the first time in many years and began helping resettle the people who had retreated into the heart of Germany with the German army from the onslaught of the Soviets. And that's how the Estonians and the Latvians and all those people got here.
Endo Mido from Tallinn, Estonia, was one of those refugees.
When the Germans came in, I was actually came out before from Forest. I was mobilized by the Russian army, and I never went. So I was living in a forest like a forest man, hiding. So I came to Tallinn, and the German army came in, and sure, we all looked them as liberators. I felt it too, because I didn't have to go to Russian army anymore, and then, because if they had caught me, I would have been shot. I mean, I was a deserter, right?
Endo Mido and millions of Eastern European refugees in displaced persons camps in Germany had no place to go. They did not want to return home to live under Soviet rule, and no other country would have them. U.S. immigration policy from the 1920s was highly restrictive, especially in regard to Eastern Europeans. But that was to change in 1948. As a Cold War measure, the U.S. opened its doors to refugees from communism. The 1948 Displaced Persons Act required that immigrants have an assurance of a job and housing in the United States. For some, that would be Seabrook Farms. Albert and Elsa Vilms came from Estonia with the help of two pastors from the Estonian Lutheran Church in America.
In 1948 started a rumor that a man in New Jersey, we didn't know where the New Jersey is at all, so I thought America's a big country, many New Jerseys maybe. That a man there, he is trying to arrange displaced persons to come to the States. Seabrook needs laborers.
Elsa Wilms.
The two pastors actually talked to Mr. Seabrook, and so the deal was arranged to get him workers, gardeners, and so on.
The 1948 Displaced Persons Act gave preference to immigrants from agricultural backgrounds. To increase their chances of acceptance in the U.S., the Wilms and many others proclaimed that they were farmers.
And of course, we were all, had all worked in the fields and been connected with agriculture and so on, which wasn't true at all.
So we were all farmers who came here. And I remember only one person. He actually had work in a factory, but the rest, they were all office workers or teachers or medical doctors and this kind of people, but all workers.
In fact, many who came to Seabrook were overqualified for work in a cannery. Albert Wilms was a lawyer and mayor of a small town. Most were unaccustomed to factory work, and the living conditions were less than ideal. Endomito had been a law student in Estonia.
No, everything was exciting. We were glad to be free. Of course, when we came to Seabrook, some people were maybe a little bit disappointed, because when we started to leave, it was, I guess, German war prisoners' camp, barracks. And so we came from barracks and we traveled all the long way, and the first thing he went was go to the barracks again. But we were treated very well.
Again, Albert Wilms.
First time we had to work in two shifts, from 7 to 6, from 6 to 7. So, and the man worked one shift, the woman worked another shift. They meet each other on the way going home and going to work. First night I had to work on the line. I have never worked in such place. And I thought I had a friend next to me, and he was an office worker too. We looked at the clock, and we were waiting when the clock will be 6, we can go. And I at that time I said, this is the first and last night I am here.
Again, Elsa Wilms.
My first night was awful. The water was rushing in the plant, terrible steam everywhere, and asparagus was worked at this time, and you had to stand on the line and push them that they go straight nicely in a line.
Running line, you know.
And I had an Estonian woman beside me, and she fainted. Dear me, I was so panicked. She has worked already a little time here, and she collapses. But I knew we had to do it, because we weren't allowed to take a single penny with us when we left Germany.
For C.F. Seabrook, the chance to sponsor Eastern European refugees was a humanitarian opportunity that matched his political beliefs. And it was a source of pride, according to his grandson, John Seabrook, a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine.
My grandfather, he'd enjoyed traveling in Europe a lot when he was younger, made a lot of trips there, had an office in Berlin, and then when he got into poor health in the late 30s and early 40s, stopped going and hadn't been for a long time. And I think a lot of it was just like he could be a big man again in Eastern Europe. This was a chance for him to go back in a kind of heroic role, you know, and organize the, you know, which must have been a very complicated thing, getting them over. And also, you know, again, my cynical realism, I think, you know, the anti-communism of the Estonians and the Latvians at that time which was very strong because, you know, the Soviet Union was marching into their country, was something that appealed to Tsiev because he was a real anti-communist. I mean, a real one, one of the real McCarthy types.
C.F. Seabrook had a special affection for the Estonian community in Seabrook and their culture.
We had a choir of 60 people. Maybe it helped us because old C.F. Seabrook, he liked music. He liked singing and he liked the choir. And in May already, in the beginning of 1950, went to New York. The choir, 60 people, and old Seabrook came with the choir.
The farming and packing operation at Seabrook thrived through the 1950s. The first generation of Japanese, Caribbean Islanders, and Eastern Europeans, for the most part, stayed in Seabrook. Many moved up the ranks and prospered with the company. In 1955, Life magazine published a feature story on Seabrook Farms, calling it the biggest vegetable factory on earth. But a fundamental distrust within the Seabrook family would bring disaster. Within 4 years, C.F. Seabrook would sell the company and disinherit his sons who had worked so hard to build the Seabrook empire. Jack Seabrook.
After the war, Seabrook was a great success, partially, I think, due to my brother Courtney's great salesmanship. But the consumer business was expanding, and 1958 was the best year that we'd ever had in our company history, made more money than we ever had made before. But now CF was 78 years old. He probably had Alzheimer's, although we never actually had it diagnosed.
Seabrook Farms went out of business with my grandfather and his three sons had a disagreement. His sons had taken over the company, and out of pique or whatever, he sold it.
James Seabrook, another grandson of the founder, C.F.
I grew up knowing how not to get along. At the Thanksgiving dinner, half the table didn't speak to the other half. Somebody would say, would you tell him to pass the butter? I mean, not kidding, you know, just fathers and sons. I mean, you know, it happens in some families, and he and his father, he pushed his father out when he was 20 years old. And maybe that's what he feared also, you know.
My mother used to say, that's why he keeps you boys at such arm's length. He's scared to death you'll do it to him. And once, when he had all of his faculties and when he was strong, he figured he was better than any of us, and he was. So he didn't worry about it. But once he'd had the stroke, and from then on, he never had the confidence he had before. He became almost paranoid about that. And as I say, if I had been educated as a psychiatrist, I would have understood that he would not appreciate his sons making a go of something he had failed at.
I mean, my father, you know, I mean, he took a stand, saying CF was mentally incompetent to manage his affairs. And so I think to this day,
again, New Yorker writer John Seabrook, who helped his father prepare his speech for the reunion.
There's a certain amount of, he feels a certain pressure to continue with that line, that, you know, to paint his father in a way that makes him perhaps seem more incompetent physically than he was, because that should have justified his behavior.
Whatever the motivation for C.F. Seabrook's actions, Seabrook Farms passed into outside hands.
So, for the second time in history, there were no Seabrooks owning or running Seabrook Farms, and the new owners weren't interested in Seabrook, New Jersey, or New Jersey, for that matter. Production slowed, and eventually the great plant ground to a halt and closed. Farmers didn't have a place for their crops, and employees lost their jobs. But there's a happy ending. In 1977, two of CF's eldest grandsons, Jimmy Seabrook, very prominent here, and his older brother, Charlie. Charlie is attending the Frozen Food Convention, and they made the mistake of convening that at the time of this. They should have known better. So he's not here. They built a new freezing plant about 3 miles down track, down the track that CF built, from the old plant and went into business. They've been joined by, between them, they have 5 sons. So there's 7 Seabrooks in that business, and no wonder they call it Seabrook Brothers and Sons, which is the new name. They, of course, had no legal right to the name Seabrook Farms or the brand. And it wasn't until April of this year that Jimmy and Charlie were able to acquire that.
Today, the Seabrook Farms brand is back in the family. Most of the younger generation of Japanese Americans and Eastern Europeans have moved away. There aren't many jobs to be had in the farm country of southern New Jersey. C.F. Seabrook died in 1964. The meaning of his life and the lessons of Seabrook Farms in the war years depend on who's doing the remembering.
So Jack was really saying a lot of nice things about his father because all these people remember it that way. But within the family, he was a tough character and ruthless.
There's certainly a lot of differences there. I mean, the Japanese viewed him as a kind of a savior, or at least that was the way he was portrayed at that reunion. And I viewed him as something of a destroyer. I mean, he was the reason that we weren't living in Seabrook anymore. He was the reason that, you know, my father never spoke to his sister. He was the reason that, you know, my dad basically got disowned. I mean, he's the reason that there's all kinds of strange little currents of distrust or bad feeling that are still rippling out, I think, from that sort of central breakdown in the family.
My father had almost no relationship with anyone who was close to him. He couldn't deal one-on-one with his own family. But on the other hand, he had a great ability to relate to a mass of people, none of whom were really going to get inside and get close to him.
The man was all for money. We made him a lot of money. I'll never forget what he said one day. The frozen food, they got this great big belt, you know, and the people have to pack them like this, yeah. And I never forget that, what he said. He come and he stand up, he was dressed down, and he looked at it, he said, yum, yum, yum. Money, money, money.
Well, Seabrook Farms represents to me my lifetime residence now that I have never regretted. It's a place that uniquely represented to the whole nation, I believe, how diverse cultures and various ethnic groups can work together. And I believe that was something that we needed to tell the whole nation about, that it is possible.
We decided we have to work because we had to give our children education, and there was no other way to work. We were ready to work. When we came to the States, we were ready to work, any kind of work.
My feelings are shared, of course, by my brother and sister and probably other kids of intern, first generation and second generation Japanese Americans and Japanese Latin Americans. And I think it's only now when you start thinking about the incredible hardship and struggle that they had to face up to and endure that you realize the magnitude of what it was that they went through and what they did for us. And so it becomes especially emotional and meaningful you know, when you're celebrating a 50-year reunion of the establishment of this little town called Seabrook.
Seabrook at War was written and produced by Marty Goldenson and David Stephen Cohen. It was narrated by Kurt Vonnegut, Jr. The mix by David Rapkin. The executive producer was Alice Weiss. We wish to thank the New Jersey State Archives, New Jersey Network, Seabrook Brothers and Sons, the Seabrook Cultural and Educational Center, John Fiume, Renford Glanville, Howard Green, Endel Mito, Ginzo Hisako and Seki Morono, Ellen Nakamura, Sema Pearson and Donna Pearson, Alfred Fannerer, Lou Presti, George Sakamoto, Fuji Sasaki, Walt Gradsky, Jack Seabrook, James Seabrook, John Seabrook, Yuan Simonson, Albert and Elsie Vilms. This program was a production of WWFM WWNJ, the Mercer County Community College Public Radio Network, New Jersey, and the New Jersey Historical Commission. It was funded by grants from the New Jersey Historical Commission and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Additional funding was provided by CoreState's New Jersey National Bank.